You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. The American body is in trouble. Unprecedented numbers of us suffer from obesity, heart disease, diabetes, and other debilitating illnesses. The root cause is a once revolutionary idea that seemed to offer so much promise, but instead has become the cause of a global health crisis: processed foods. Over the past 75 years, a number of factors aligned to create a reality in which processed carbohydrates became our main food source. In a new book titled Fast Carbs, Slow Carbs, best-selling author and former FDA commissioner David A. Kessler explains how the quest to feed a nation resulted in a population that is increasingly suffering from obesity and chronic disease, and he offers a solution for changing course. And today, Dr. Kessler joins me on the podcast to reveal how his own battle to control his weight helped inspire his new book, the difference between how our bodies digest fast carbs versus slow carbs, and why fad diets that cut out carbs altogether might not be such a good idea either. David outlines the long list of diseases that can be traced to heavy consumption of processed foods, some of the tricks that the food industry employs to mislead consumers about what's in many processed foods, and he even suggests some changes that he'd like to make to nutritional labels that he helped create when he was head of the FDA under Presidents Bush and Clinton. He also expresses his concern over Americans' heavy reliance on processed junk foods at a time when fresh meats and produce are in short supply. He shares what he's telling former Vice President Joe Biden as a member of his campaign's coronavirus advisory team, and he gives his own health recommendations for keeping your family safe from COVID-19. Coming up with Dr. David Kessler in just a moment. David Kessler served as commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration under Presidents George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, where he helped design the nutritional facts label and took on big tobacco. He is a pediatrician and has been the dean of the medical schools at Yale and the University of California, San Francisco. Now he's continuing his crusade to get America to eat better with a new book titled Fast Carbs, Slow Carbs: The Simple Truth About Food, Weight, and Disease. Dr. Kessler, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be with you.
Well, you say in this book that you were at least partly inspired to write it by your own struggles with weight. Tell us a little about that.
I have suits in every size.
Me
probably,
too.
over my lifetime, I have gained and lost my body weight, you know, several times over. And I've never understood what is at the core. Why is it so hard? I can lose weight, then I gained it back, and just this cycle of, you know, weight loss, gaining it back. That was the fundamental question that I was trying to understand.
Is there such a thing as healthy at any size? Can someone actually be just genetically predisposed to be overweight but still be healthy?
I wish I could reassure people. I wish I could reassure myself that there's such a thing as healthy weight. But the fact is, as we age, excess weight becomes a problem. There was one number that stood out to me that really shaped my thinking. Only 12.2% of us are metabolically healthy. That's true for weight, blood pressure, blood lipids, blood pressure. So there is a there are real consequences. And while you may be healthy struggle with weight today, as you get older, those metabolic consequences, they drive our bodies into metabolic chaos. And they have real consequences when it comes to diabetes and cardiovascular disease. I mean, think about it. 87% of us don't meet the basic medical guidelines for metabolic health.
That's shocking. And now what if you eat really healthily, but you just hate to work out? And I'm one of those people, although I don't know that I eat quite so healthily as I should. Does healthy eating necessarily negate the need for regular exercise?
No. I mean, I wish that were the case. I mean, certainly, if you are a healthy weight and you are eating healthy, I mean, that's all to the good. But for the most of us who struggle with our weight, I mean, who are trying to keep any weight off that we've lost or trying to lose weight or have any of these metabolic issues, exercise, I mean, think of it this way. Exercise maintains our metabolic flexibility. They allow us to remain insulin sensitive, to keep our insulin working. They're a sink, they're a drain, right? Which by which when we do overeat, you know, those excess calories can go down. So exercise is key. It's one of the key, you know, three basic recommendations that I give. If exercise, moderate intensity daily, is a key to good health.
Now, in this book, you particularly take on something called fast carbs, but I wonder what you think about all of these low-carb diets like paleo and keto these days. Is it a good idea to just cut out carbs altogether?
The question is, which carbs are we talking about? Mm-hmm. And that really is the key. So by fast carbs, right, I mean sugar and starch. And over the past half centuries, you know, we Americans have greatly increased their average intake of fast carbs. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just, we all know the problems with sugar, but it's sugar and starch. Understand what goes on. You know, you go to Mount Vernon, you look at George Washington's home, and you look in the main room, look at the ceiling, and you see carved in that ceiling are these sheaves of wheat. And you have, you know, the wheat stalk. I mean, the fundamental crop, right? Washington wanted to be us to become the granary to the world when he wrote to Lafayette. And you have that wheat stalk, and you go up that wheat stalk, and there's that wheat berry, that kernel, right? And there are multiple layers around that wheat berry. And within that wheat berry, there's the endosperm, the energy, the gold in essence, that has sustained societies for thousands of years. But what happened? What we have done, if you walk down the supermarket, not just milling that wheat, but the kind of processing that our food, many of our foods, our packaged foods, when you walk down that supermarket island, that wheat, that starch, has had that intact structure of that natural grain pummeled out of them. And that altered structure, that processed food, makes that starch so rapidly absorbed that we're flooding our bodies with glucose. And no one asked what the consequences were of just adding this endless flood of this, not only sugar, but starch, this rapidly absorbable glucose that gets very quickly absorbed in our upper GI tract and can lead to the consequences that we're seeing.
So then what is the difference between a fast carb and a slow carb? Give us an example of a slow carb so I have something to compare it to.
So a slow carb is a vegetable, a legume, It's a high fiber food. It's an intact whole grain. Yes, it may have the outer layers of bran taken out of it, but it doesn't have the entire structure of that wheat kernel pummeled out. It's foods that have their structure intact.
Okay.
Those are slow carbs. Fast carbs get rapidly absorbed in our GI tract. So, you know, when we're eating these fast carbs, I mean, it's almost as if the food is pre-digested. It increases, there's no structure to that food. It increases our eating rate. It gets absorbed very quickly. It stimulates certain hormones that increase insulin. It doesn't stimulate other hormones that give satiety and fullness. It doesn't get all the way down in the GI tract, so it doesn't interact with the microbiome. So we're absorbing 100% of the calories. There are multiple mechanisms by which these fast carbs cause harm. And for the vast majority of those of us who struggle with weight, adding these fast carbs, and it's like adding fuel to the fire.
Although humans have been processing foods in one form or another for centuries, what's the difference between how foods were processed back then versus how foods are processed today?
So two differences. One, the kind of techniques that we use today, it's not just milling. Of course, you have to mill the wheat in order to eat it, but what's called extrusion cooking, where this starch is added after it's been milled to these processing machines that exert very high temperatures, great deal of shear forces. It destroys the structure of that starch granule, so it increases the surface area, so it's rapidly absorbed. So it is the degree of processing, the degree of the extent of destroying the structure of the food that is different. And also the fact is, you know, 100 years ago, we were not in the positive energy balance that we're in today. You know, we were lucky to get enough food. And when, in that circumstance, you know, I don't think, you know, this rapidly absorbable glucose created as much a problem as it does when you're already in a positive energy balance, where you have where this metabolic chaos that's going on. So very different environments, very different processing.
Well, what's the cost of this? I mean, what kind of diseases are associated with heavy consumption of these processed foods?
Enormous consequences. A third of us by 2030 are going to be diabetic. And, you know, today maybe 90 million of us are pre-diabetic. And that diabetes leads to heart, kidney, multiple manifestations. Even in the current environment, when we talk about underlying conditions and who is susceptible,
right,
diabetes is one of those conditions because it does weaken the immune system.
Well, I've been hearing that, and I was wondering what it was about diabetes in particular that made people so susceptible to coronavirus. Just in general, their immune system takes a hit?
Exactly. I mean, it's the decrease in the power of the immune system. And diabetes is associated with much more, many more inflammatory processes. So there really is a lot of damage that can emanate. And, you know, it's very interesting. Just reducing the amount of starch, reducing the amount of sugar and starch from the diet can have a dramatic effect on people's blood sugar. And people who have struggled with diabetes, by reducing sugar and starch, can dramatically aid in improvement of the disease.
In addition to being a factor with all of these different diseases, you even say in here that processed foods actually prevent you from feeling satisfied. And it becomes sort of, I guess, a vicious cycle where the more you eat, the more you want. Kind of the old Pringles slogan, you can't eat just one. How does that work? How does eating these foods continue to make us hungrier?
Two mechanisms. First, these foods get so rapidly absorbed in the upper GI tract that they don't go all the way down to the lower GI tract, so they don't stimulate the hormones that are associated with fullness and satiety. And they also, because they are so hyperpalatable, that they trigger the reward centers of the brain. So you don't get the satiety or fullness, you get the feeling, the hit, a momentary activation of the reward circuit. So both mechanisms are at play. If you really wanted to understand the power of foods, I mean, just certainly in these times of stress, people are lonely, people are shut in, a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear. You know, these starch is really the delivery vehicle it gets for fat, sugar, and salt. It gets added. Remember when we were, you know, in kindergarten, you add water to starch and it's this paste, it doesn't have a lot of taste. Add fat and sugar and salt to it, and you can activate the reward centers of the brain. Then you have this momentary bliss, right? You zone out, you engage in that repetitive behavior. Then 5 minutes later, you go, why did I do that? So that's reward centers of the brain taking over. But you also have, because these are so highly processed, they're not getting down the entire GI tract.
Can you walk us through the grocery store? Because I feel like a lot of times we're not aware of what processed foods are. Something may sound healthy, but then it's not. And we kind of know that potato chips and cookies and that kind of thing, those are processed foods. Those have fast carbs. But I have a feeling that there are a lot of things out there on our shelves that we're not even aware of unless we look at the label. And even that can be deceiving.
60% of our of our processed foods have starch as their main ingredient. So if you see wheat or flour as the first or second ingredient, and that's the majority of food, you could be assured, and it's in a package, that's a processed food.
Really?
And that's a fast carb, yes. And those are going to get rapidly absorbed. That glucose, in essence, it's no different than sugar. Let me give you a food label, for example. You know that nutrition facts panel on all foods?
Right.
So let me give you an example. Now, remember, back about 20, 30 years ago when we did the food label, what were the dietary guidelines? Right. It was to limit sugars, to limit total fat, limit saturated fat, right? But to increase what they call complex carbohydrates. So let me give you this this label. Here's a food. You'll tell me what, see if you can guess what the food is. It has 300 calories. Total fat, zero. Saturated fat, zero. Sugar, zero. Has some salt, has some protein, but it simply says 30 grams total carbohydrates. What do you think that is?
If I was to guess, maybe a Kind bar, one of these energy bars.
It's a bagel.
Oh, okay.
So what is that bagel, right? I mean, that is starch.
Yeah.
Now, is there any sugar in it? No. Is there any fat in it? No. So it sort of met the guidelines, right? But that bagel, and I don't want to be, you know, have your listeners come and accuse me of taking on the bagel, right? Because I will tell you, I have bagels in my freezer right now. But the fact is that bagel, that starch, can increase the amount of one's blood glucose, the equivalent of some 20 teaspoons of pure sugar. So even though there's no sugar in it, that flour gets so rapidly absorbed that it acts so that it can increase blood glucose the same as pure sugar.
And you bring up an interesting subject here. In the 1970s, the McGovern Committee drew up a set of dietary guidelines for Americans. Of course, back then, we probably thought that a bowl of Frosted Flakes was a healthy breakfast. But have those guidelines evolved much since then? And what do you think they got wrong?
Well, I think what we got wrong is that there are good carbohydrates and carbohydrates that are not good for us. right? There are those carbohydrates that are fastly absorbed, rapidly absorbed, the processed carbohydrates, and there are carbohydrates such as vegetables and legumes and high fiber foods that are slowly absorbed that are good for us. Mm-hmm. So we didn't make that distinction. And there's the rub.
And when you were the head of the FDA, you were instrumental in creating the nutritional facts labels that we all see on packaged consumer food items. Are there things that you maybe didn't realize 20 years ago that you now wish had been included on those labels?
We used the term complex carbohydrates back mm-hmm. then.
Right.
I don't think that term should be used today, because just because something is not sugar, just because it's complex, the real issue, there are complex carbohydrates that are rapidly absorbed, that are fast carbs, and there are those that are not rapidly absorbed. So we didn't understand that distinction. And that's, again, based the science really has evolved since we did the label in the early 1990s.
Do you think that nutritional labels put too much focus on calories?
I think calories are important. I don't think there's any way you can get around okay. the fact that calories aren't important. But it's also the quality of the food that we're eating. There's this mantra that a calorie is a calorie. I mean, if that were the case, then broccoli, would be the same, a calorie, a vegetable would be the same as a calorie from a soda. And that mm-hmm. just is not the case.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. And the food industry has gotten very good at disguising unhealthy products in healthy-sounding language. What are some of the tricks that they employ to confuse consumers, even with the label?
It's just the term whole grain.
Mm-hmm. Really?
So some whole grains are anything but whole grains. Hmm. I mean, obviously, the grains need to be milled, and there needs to be some cooking associated with the product. But what you see is that some whole grains, the starch is as refined as white flour, and it just simply has the bran and germ added back in, but it has been pummeled just like any other fast carb. So it's really not an intact whole grain.
And you also encourage Americans to eat more of a plant-based diet, but you caution people to be wary of foods that are labeled as plant-based. Can those be misleading as well?
Well, it depends what kind of, when we're talking about what kind of plant-based diet it is. There are mm-hmm. unhealthy plant-based diets, and there are healthy plant-based diets. Understand, the reason why I think vegetables and legumes are so good for us is because the vast majority of them they're not high in starch, and they have the structure intact. They have the fiber mm-hmm. that is in its natural state. So the food gets down throughout the entire length of our GI tract, which I think can make a major difference in our health. Mm-hmm. Now, the book, the fast carbs, slow carbs, well, we've been talking about reducing or limiting the ingestion of fast carbs.
Right.
And I think that is key. I think that is at the root of metabolic disease. It has some other recommendations, because what I tried to do was cut through the noise. There's a lot of confusion. Should I be eating keto, Mediterranean, paleo? What kind of diet should I be eating? I stood up at the American Heart Association meetings, and there was a representative advocating each one of those diets. And I said, what can we all agree that if we eliminate fast carbs, right, we could dramatically improve our health? Mm-hmm. And everyone said yes. So no matter what diet you're on, the core issue, I think, are these fast carbs. But there are other opportunities to dramatically affect our health. And, so the number one recommendation is limit fast carbs. But also, I think there's an enormous opportunity, in our lifetime to wipe out 70-80% of atherosclerotic heart disease. The fact is, we now know, because I mean, if you're going to give up fast carbs, what are you going to substitute it with? You remember the old Atkins diet, talking about eating butter and saturated fat. You know, and while I think fast carbs are the main culprit, I think we have to be careful what we substitute for them. And the bottom line is, if you go and eat an Atkins-like diet, you're gonna look. The data is gonna vary, and it's. I'm humbled as a physician, on you know that everybody has somewhat of a different response. But on average, you increase your, what's called your LDL. It's a blood lipid by about 10% if you go eat a lot of saturated fat. Not everybody is the same. Some it makes no difference. Some it increases 30%. But the fact is, we now know that LDL particles cause atherosclerotic heart disease. Now, more specifically, it's the ApoB containing LDL particles. But those are the cause. Those are certainly in the causal chain of atherosclerotic heart disease. If we can get everyone's LDL down significantly in this country, we can wipe out the vast majority of atherosclerotic heart disease. Now, you can do that through drugs, you can do that through diet, but the best diet to get your LDL down is a true plant-based diet. And in some individuals, you can get down by some 40%. And other individuals, you know, they can go on to take drugs. You know, I don't want to, the choice between diet and drugs, you should see your doctor and talk to your doctor. There are advantages of both methods, but, you know, lowering LDL as much as you can, I mean, it can have a dramatic effect on the risk of heart disease.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Kessler. This is something I've long been curious about. These energy bars, these protein bars, is there any such thing as a healthy energy bar? Aren't those mostly junk too?
You look at it and you go, is it real food? Right? Now, obviously, if they're nuts and fresh fruit, I mean, that is better than those that are just processed carbohydrates. The key is to look for the structure of food, right? I mean, look and see, does it look like food? I mean, is the structure? I mean, anything that's highly processed is going to get rapidly absorbed. And those foods are problematic.
That's a pretty good heuristic. So if it looks like there was a long process from the plant or from the factory or whatever to the store, then that's probably going to be pretty processed, huh? Just common sense, I guess.
Absolutely. And chances are that a key, you know, the majority of that process, that product is going to be processed carbs.
As a pediatrician, I assume that you must be particularly concerned with childhood obesity. Are kids especially vulnerable to processed foods and these fast carbs? Do the companies that make them know how to get kids' attention?
Well, they certainly know how to get kids' attention by advertising. And I mean, over the years, and there's been certain guidelines that have been put in place. So no doubt, you know, I mean, this begins at an early age. You know, even with lipids, blood lipids,
Really?
right? I mean, I want to get blood lipids down in this country. We can wipe out, you know, heart disease, heart attack, stroke considerably, maybe 70-80%. But understand that LDL problem is a lifelong problem. You accumulate your LDL burden throughout your lifetime. Remember, we used to talk about the number of pack years that you would accumulate, you know, over a lifetime. Your LDL, you know, your risk of heart attack is the result of LDL over your lifetime. Now, so I'm increasingly concerned about blood lipids, certainly early on. And, you know, while I think, you know, children and adolescents pose a unique challenge, certainly if you're in your 20s or your 30s, it's not too early to want to be able to get your LDL down and keep it that way, because your risk for heart attack and stroke is going to be dependent upon your lifelong accumulation.
And the amount of processed foods that people consume also tends to closely follow socioeconomic lines. What do you say to, say, an urban working mom who's barely scraping by when a head of lettuce might cost $2.50, but she can feed her kid a Twinkie or a pack of Lunchables for $1.50 or less?
You know, I am enormously, I understand that. And it's not just the dollars, it's also the time involved,
mm-hmm.
right?
Right.
And to be able to make foods that are healthy. I'm not sure the data supports the fact that, you know, you can eat healthy if you work at it. It doesn't have to be that much more expensive. But you're right. Food is not accessible in all communities, healthy foods. That's why, you know, this improvement in school lunches has been so key. And we need to continue to, you know, when we're back to school and we're feeding our kids, these are investments that are well worth making.
And let me ask you this. Even if the industry wanted to move away from producing processed foods, it seems to me that it's hard to imagine how they would pivot to making something else. It's not like they're going to suddenly start selling fresh produce. It seems to me that the business model is really designed to do one thing, and it doesn't lend itself to adaptation. For them, do they see this war on processed food as something of an existential threat?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head. But understand, this has been building, you know, we built this infrastructure that is based on us being the granary to the world and
right.
being able to process foods over the last 200 years. So I'm not even sure they even can comprehend, you know, the implications of what this endless stream of fast carbs and rapidly absorbable glucose has done to our bodies. Now, look, they will respond to consumers, right? But we have to change as a society what we want to eat. Now, I want to be very careful. I don't want to make the, you know, there are differences. But you remember, we were privileged to do the investigation into the tobacco industry and regulate tobacco
That's
to
right.
kids.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you think about it, what really changed there? Certainly my grandparents and my parents' generation, they viewed the cigarette as something they wanted, something that was adventuresome and sexy. You know, certainly there were regulations and legislation and lawsuits, et cetera, but that really wasn't the key. There was a critical perceptual shift. We changed how America viewed that cigarette. And we need to do the same. Again, very different products. I'm not equating the two, but I am saying when we look at these fast carbs, right, these highly processed carbohydrates, we have to view them differently than the way we have.
Are there industry incentives that could be enacted at the government level, or do you see this as entirely being a burden that falls on the consumer's shoulders?
I think if we fix the food label, I think if we improve, for example, disclosure of, you know, the fact that this food is really just fast carbs, that we don't just hide mm-hmm. behind the label where it says total carbohydrates, where we clean up the ingredient panel and give consumers information and certainly explain to consumers that at the root of much of this metabolic chaos, metabolic disease, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, problems with weight are these fast carbs. I think that information, that changing how we view it, is going to be the biggest incentive for the industry because they're going to adapt if the consumer adapts.
Well, looking at the moment that we're in right now with the coronavirus and much of America hoarding food, supply chains being disrupted, and the potential for this to impact farms, it seems to me that it's much easier to get and store junk food like Oreos and potato chips than it is to even find fresh produce, much less be able to keep it and store it. Do you worry that after making so much progress in getting the public to choose healthier options over the past couple of decades, all of this crisis buying might get them hooked on processed foods all over again?
I don't want to. You raise just a terrific point. I don't want to in any way minimize, and I think we have to be very sensitive, the amount of stress and anxiety and mm-hmm. real fear there is out there. And having comfort is key. But when we're through this, and we are going to get through this, we're going to want to be healthy. And okay. The best way, you know, while processed foods can give you that momentary hit, you know, when we're through this, right, I mean, eliminating fast carbs from our diet, I mean, can have a major, major impact. But I don't want to say anything that takes away any comfort from anybody at this moment in time.
Interesting. Well, as we wind up here, I'd love to get your two cents on what's going on with the coronavirus. I hear some people debate over what the real danger is, whether it's, you know, airborne particles or whether it's touching and then touching the face. You know, if you have to choose, what's the biggest help, a mask or gloves, or what kind of advice are you giving to people?
So if we had enough masks, so we didn't have to take them away from our healthcare workers.
Sure.
Right? I mean, so right now we have to prioritize.
Sure. And or homemade masks, let's say.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, regrettably, we don't have enough masks, mm-hmm. right? And they have to go to our healthcare workers. But if you're an essential worker and you're engaging in any degree of density, and we don't have enough testing to know who is shedding the virus, because you can be asymptomatic and shedding it, I think masks are an important piece of the armamentarium. But I think it's not just masks. I mean, it's good hand washing, it's social distancing. We do all three, and we will be able to get over this sooner.
Good.
There's no doubt that just talking within, you know, 6 feet or so, it's not just sneezing or coughing, but
talking can spread
these particles. The question you're asking me is, do these particles stay in the air, you know, once I talk or I sneeze or I emanate these particles emanate from my mouth, do they go straight to the ground or they stay in the air for hours or days? There's some disagreement on that. Mm-hmm. It does not look like they are highly aerosolized. So right now, it's if you're going to come in contact with the particles from my talking, my sneezing, my coughing, we're going to shake hands, I'm going to have those viruses on my hands, or that those viral particles land on the ground or on the surface, and they can stay alive for several hours. So I think we have a pretty good idea on how they are transmitted. I don't think they're highly aerosolized, but I think masks, I mean, if you have it and you have to work, I think there is no doubt. Certainly as we go back to work and if we have to be in close quarters, that is a tool.
Yeah. Well, as the father of a newborn, I'd also like to get your advice as a pediatrician. I keep hearing that seniors are far more at risk at children, and the risk to kids seems to be sort of downplayed in the media. Is that true? Can we take some comfort that babies and kids are somehow more resilient against COVID-19?
So I think that generally is the way what's coming across in the media. This weekend there was some newer data on you know, what the effect of this virus was on pregnancy, and could it be transmitted? We're learning a lot more. You know, some of the studies on pregnancy, for example, were done in the third trimester. It wasn't done early on. We're seeing some antibodies in that can occur in the fetus. So recognize the fact we don't have the whole story. Mm-hmm. I think that if you're pregnant, or I mean, in any case, when you have a newborn, I think that certainly socially distancing the family from others and very good hand washing is in order.
I'm not sure where you're actually based here, but how would you grade how this crisis has been handled in your state and at the federal level so far?
You know, I think there'll be plenty of time to focus on that.
Yeah.
once we get through this.
Yeah.
You know, my job, is to look forward. You know, one point of disclosure, just so I put it out there, you know, a few of us are on a near daily basis advising former Vice President Joe Biden.
Really?
I'm doing that. I want to just disclose that.
Okay.
But this is not a this is not a political issue.
Okay.
This is a public health issue, and we need to get through it, and then we can mm-hmm. learn the lessons
right.
of how to do it better. Hopefully, there's no next time. But I think we're going to realize that without a vaccine, without an antiviral that can prevent us from getting this, right? Until we have that vaccine, we're going to need to change how we work and socially interact, even when we're on the descent of the epidemiology curves.
Mm. Well, I'm curious then, when you're advising Joe Biden and his team, what kind of advice are you giving him in this crisis?
We're spending most of the time on the data.
Okay.
It is very data driven. Mm-hmm. We are going over the models of where we are today, state by state, city by city. When is this going to peak? How many ventilators? Mm-hmm. How many beds? What are we going to run out of? It is a data driven public health mm-hmm. briefing.
Is there anything in that data that you've found particularly surprising recently?
You know, I think that the fact is that, we are focused on primarily this, first Washington state, and now no doubt New York and the Northeast mm-hmm. is the epicenter. But we have to worry about the rest of the country and the
yeah.
middle of the country and how this is going to roll out. Other cities, we're already seeing Detroit, Chicago, Atlanta, New Orleans be involved. So this is going to be a very intense, and in some ways, just for certain families, tragic next month or so. So we will get through it. And we will develop a vaccine. It will take time. We will develop antivirals that will work.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone contributing what they can by keeping their distance from others, because then we really are not giving the virus an ability to spread. If it can't jump from one person to the next, that's our best defense against
yeah.
this virus until we have a vaccine.
Yeah, definitely good advice. Well, before we go, as the former FDA commissioner, what would you like to see that agency do to ensure that a safe vaccine gets to the market as soon as humanly possible?
I think it's going to take a great deal of cooperation, getting companies to share information, be able to begin manufacturing different candidate viruses even before we have all the data. So if the data shows that it is effective, that we can quickly make it available. Enormous amount of work on the FDA's plate.
Yeah, well, let's certainly hope so. Well, once more, Dr. David Kessler's new book is called Fast Carbs, Slow Carbs, The Simple Truth About Food, Weight, and Disease. Dr. Kessler, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Thanks again to Dr. David Kessler for joining me on the show. Order his new book, Fast Carbs, Slow Carbs, The Simple Truth About Food, Weight, and Disease, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com. And I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.